Hi everybody, and welcome to Spotlight once more. This is Steve in the centre of England, and before we start I'd just as usual like to thank the people behind the scenes, Becky for all the work she does on Spotlight, arranging the interviews and coming up with the ideas, and on this occasion to Dennis for doing the recording for you. And today I'm going to be introducing to you a personal friend of ours who lives very close to me. In fact, in for the people terms, he's just practically next door to me. He's only a matter of, 20 to 25 miles away from me. And that's very, very close, of course. His name's Jeff Grant, and here he's known as Cheeky Monkey. And welcome, Jeff. Thanks for agreeing to be interviewed. And can I start by asking you where you were actually born?
Okay, Steve. Yeah. Well, I was born in a market town just outside Leicester, a place called Market Harborough. And Leicester, for the benefit of the people who don't know the geography of England so well, it's the Midlands area, about 100 miles north of London. Yes, I was born there, and then after about, when I was about 7 or 8, I moved to Leicester.
Okay, and Market Harbour is a very, very pretty, picturesque little town. It's quite a beautiful area. So you lived in a very, very nice place, Jeff, and then you moved to Leicester City. What about your parents? What did your parents do for occupation? What about your dad, mum and dad?
Right, well, yeah, as you rightly said, it is quite a nice area. It's a quiet area. And then, of course, I had to move to Leicester because at that time I was my sight was failing, and it was a question that the school I had to go to was in Leicester, and it was one of the reasons that we moved from Market Harborough into Leicester. My father, he was an insurance man. He used to go around, you know, insuring people and so forth. And my mother, she worked as a OSHA operative, you know, sort of thing, the sort of thing like making things. And Leicester, of course, is very well known, as you know, Steve, for hosiery and the shoe industry and so forth, and also engineering. But in this case, yes, my mother was in the hosiery, and my father was in the insurance.
Okay then, Jeff, so your dad was an insurance salesman, and your mum also worked. What about brothers and sisters? Do you have any brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I have one. He was my brother. He was a mechanic. He was also in a hosiery factory. My sister, she worked... I think he was in some office at one time, and then I think she went also into the hosiery. My brother is a little older than me, and my sister is about 10 years younger than I am.
Okay, that's fine. Now, you mentioned a few seconds back that you were at the stage where you moved from Market Harbour to Leicester, your sight was failing. Does that mean then that from a child, from birth, you were fully sighted?
No, in actual fact, yes, when I was born, they didn't realize at the time, and that one of my eyes was just non-functional, was completely blind, and the other eye was almost perfect. And it was on an occasion, in actual fact, my father, he dropped a coin on the floor, and he dropped it on the blind side, as it were, and I couldn't find the coin. So he dropped it on the other side, and of course I found it, and it was at that stage that they realized there was something wrong with my eyes. And of course I had it checked, and yes, my left eye was never any good at all, but my right was perfectly okay at the time.
So your sight gradually deteriorated over a period of several years, and did you eventually end up totally blind, or do you still have any vision at all?
Okay, Steve, yes, in actual fact, my sight deteriorated, the retina decided to pack up, and it was sorting. One day it was worse than others, and in the end, yes, I lost sight, so it was absolutely blanco at the at the end of it, and it was total, yes.
And can you remember that actually happening, and how did you react? It must have been a very traumatic experience for a child. How old were you when your sight completely went? It must have been quite a traumatic thing to happen, although you'd had problems with your eyes from an early age. To lose it completely must have been a pretty traumatic experience.
Yeah, when I lost my sight, I was just over nine years old, and looking back, I suppose it was a shock, quite a big shock, but it's surprising. I think when you're much younger, you do tend to accept these things much easier. I think when somebody is a lot older, it happens to them, it's a lot more traumatic, and it was rather strange. It didn't take me long to get myself accustomed to the situation, and it never really held me back. I was always really, I was always pretty well go ahead, and it never really stopped me from doing the things I wanted to do.
That's good to know. That's a really good attitude. Now, maybe a question which you don't really know the answer to, but were your parents helped? Were your parents given any help and guidance when this had actually happened to you?
Oh, yeah, indeed they did. My mother and father in particular, they gave me a lot of confidence. And I find that confidence in our situations is quite a key feature in our lifestyle. Without that, I think it makes life a lot more difficult. And they always gave me that confidence to carry on. And quite honestly, I didn't really realize I couldn't see. It was one of those things, I just went through life as though I could see.
So you kept all your friends, you know, your childhood friends that you'd built up at that period, they just carried on playing with you as per normal, did they? Did you go around on bikes and stuff like that, roller skates? Did you do all those things as a child?
Yeah, in actual fact, Steve, you're dead right. I did. I did all those things. We used to have a thing. I don't know if you ever remember those things. We used to make these things with a... it was like a long board, and you had wheels at the back and two at the front, and you could steer these wheels at the front, more like pram wheels, and I used to make them up. And you used to like scoot along with and jump on it and go along the pavements and that sort of thing. And yeah, I used to go up a bridge and then come down the other side, and you know, pretty fast. How I'm still alive, I shall never know, Steve.
Yeah, oh dear. Yeah, I can just imagine that. I know exactly what you mean. They used to make them out of old baby prams and stuff like that. I'm sure everybody has experienced that sort of thing. You know, in their early days, and racing around and doing all sorts of silly, crazy things. Okay, now your school. Where did you first go to school?
Well, for a start-up, Steve, I went to an ordinary school, and it wasn't very practical, and I couldn't see the blackboard, and so forth. So after a very short time, they decided I'd got to go to a special school. It was a school in Leicester called Stonygut, and I went there. It was a day school whereby you did come home at night, and you went in the morning. You didn't stay there as long as a boarding school. And education-wise, it was very basic, extremely so. And in my early days there, I was a bit of a time waster, unfortunately. I didn't do as well as I should have done, and it was only in the last 2 years that I really tried, and then I did quite well.
Now, I'm very, very curious, I'm very interested to know why you didn't actually go to a boarding school, because... going back in those days, I'm saying those days, making you sound as if you were 150, but I know you know, understand what I'm trying to say. In those days, you didn't really have a great deal of choice. You had to go to boarding school, basically. So, was your sight good enough to enable you to not go to a residential boarding school, or how did it happen that you didn't?
Right, okay, see, well, the reason I was going to go to a boarding school, in actual fact, they wanted me to go when I left school, when I was about 15, which I hadn't any sight at that time, they wanted me to go as a physio and to be trained at, I think it was called Rowton Castle. Now, you might know more about that than I see. And for some reason or other, my mother decided she didn't want me to go. So I didn't go to this school, but the school in Leicester, I was there until I was 16, and it was basic training, and they sort of the sort of things that taught you were things then to do with cane work and rapier work and that sort of stuff, and yes, you got the normal subjects like geography, history, and various things, and maths. I was quite good at maths, in actual fact. And from there, I left school, and then I started as a telephonist, of all things.
Okay, yeah, just to fill in a little detail for our friends overseas, Rowton Castle used to be, used to be part of what is now called the Royal National College for the Blind. It was a residential boarding school which took pupils from early infancy up to about 18, and then did further training in telephony and probably piano tuning and audio and shorthand typing in those days. So that's the sort of school that Jeff would have gone to, but he didn't actually go. Where did you go to do your telephony training, Jeff?
Right, Steve. Well, once again, it was pretty basic, and the education let me go to the Royal Infirmary. Now, you know the Royal Infirmary in Leicester. It's quite a big establishment, a big hospital, and the switchboard there was absolutely enormous, and it was so busy. I don't know how many lines now. I think it must have had 50 lines or something like that at the time, and numerous extensions, and I was taught there, and you can imagine being taught on one of those, because, you know, I was answering calls, and, you know, a little kid had just swallowed a penny or something, and somebody else was dying of a heart attack, and all that sort of thing. So that's where I got my training from.
Okay, again, you've led not the norm. Your experience isn't the norm of people over here, because I would have thought, I didn't know this, I guessed you were going to say that you went to Pembridge Place in London, where, again, is a residential place where people learn telephony. So you've surprised me there, Jeff. So you were actually taught on location, so to speak, by, who taught you? Just the ordinary operators, the people that were doing the job?
Exactly, Steve. It was the ordinary operators. There was a couple of girls there, and they were showing me what to do. And yes, I seem to think now, on reflection, yes, somebody else did come from the education to give me some sort of guidance. And it was the sort of switchboard. I don't know. I don't think they've still got them these days, have they? Where, you know, you put the old plugs in, and they had two rows of keys at the front. And I was taught on that, and it was a very fast sort of operation. You had to be very, very fast. I mean, the extensions were calling. Oh, it was incredible. And I think if you could have operated that switchboard, you could have operated any switchboard, Steve.
I can imagine. Yeah, I can well imagine that. It's probably still an extremely busy board now. Of course, it's one of the main hospitals in the city of Leicester, and it would be extremely busy, I've no doubt, even, well, to this day, of course. So at what age are you now? Where is Jeff in his life at this time when you were doing the switchboard at the Royal Infirmary?
Right, I would be at 16, Steve, and once I'd sort of got myself into a reasonable operator, I got a job at an office, and they were heating engineers, and that was quite a small board, and that was only about, what, 5 lines, and somewhere about 25 extensions. And so that was quite easy compared with the other one. And I stayed there for, I imagine, about 7 years. And then I went on to a bigger switchboard. And I ended up at the Ministry of Labour in Leicester. Now, I'm not sure whether our American friends would know what the American light labour would be, but it is a place where people used to go when they're unemployed and they wanted to get jobs, and I was on the switchboard there.
Okay, that's fine. So we've got you working as a switchboard operator, and you're about 16. So what did you do in your leisure time? How did you amuse yourself when you weren't working?
Okay, Steve, I'd like to say this as a side issue, that just to give you some idea of my independence, where I worked at the heating engineers before I went to the Ministry of Labour, etc., I used to walk there, and I never had a white stick, I never had a dog, and okay, the traffic was nothing like it is today, but I had to go across Italia, yes, 2 very main roads, and across parks, and all the way up there. And I was that sort of person. I was very independent, and I managed it, and I look back, I wish I could do it now, but I often wonder how I did do it, but I think when you're younger, you've got a bigger and more sensitive way of assessing things, especially sort of thing when you're walking around, you know, and yeah, that's quite a point. I'm just trying to think, what was the other question, Steve? I'm sorry.
That's okay. I was just about to ask you what you did in your leisure time, after work, and after you'd wound down, what did you do with yourself as a 16-year-old in Leicester?
Okay, Steve, yeah, I used to go around playing the piano, and I played the piano in various places. I started playing the piano in pubs. And I got quite a name, in actual fact, and I used to do quite well in these pubs, and at the time I used to sort of fill the pubs, you know, with people, and I always used to get some cracking jobs, and so that was one of my great things. I love music, and I created my own band, and then we started playing in some of the dance halls.
Okay, so you were out on the town then, and do you play by ear? Did you have lessons, or are you self-taught? How did you learn the piano? Was it a school subject, or did you just pick it up?
Okay, Steve, yeah, that's a good question. Yes, when I was at school, I was taught how to read Braille music, and I was useless. I was not very good at reading Braille music, and I'm still not. I find it very, very awkward, and I find it pretty archaic, really, the way they do it. Possibly a lot of listeners won't agree with me, but I didn't get on very, very well with it anyway. And then I went to a teacher that she was extremely good, but she was nothing to do with Braille whatsoever. And whilst I had some sort of a background in music, she then gave me lessons. She used to teach in London, and she had some very good pupils, and she used to play with bands like Henry Orr and Carol Gibbons and all them sort of people. Their bands, Steve, I wonder if you know the name of those. I don't think our American friends would, but the big bands and broadcasting bands, and she used to play with them. So she was an extremely, extremely good pianist.
Indeed, she must have been, and yes, I have actually. I've heard of those bands, no problem at all. But I've got a, like yourself, a pretty wide appreciation of all types of music. So yeah, I am familiar with those names, Jeff. So, Okay, you did the piano, and how far did you take this interest in playing the piano? Did it take you into any interesting places? And just before you answer that, I've got to ask you this one, if you don't mind. Were you dating girls at this stage? You know, did you have a steady girlfriend at this point?
Steve, Shirley's listening to this. That is my wife. And when you said that, she just said, "Was he?" So I don't know what she means by that, really. But yeah, I was, Steve. Yeah, and in actual fact, when I was at Nursery Labour as a telephonist, I used to about at past 5 at night, when it was time to finish, I used to go across to the toilets, and I used to put my evening suit on. And God, if the boss ever saw me, I don't know what he would do. But then I used to sneak out the front door with my evening suit on, and there was a car there with the boys in with the band, and I used to jump into that, and we used to go up to Sheffield and Doncaster and various places and to play at various venues. And so really, I was playing. I was working in the day, and I was working at night, and I didn't get back until sometimes 2 and 3 in the mornings. And then I had to be up at 7, half past 7, to get to my job as a telephonist. So that was quite an experience.
Yes, it certainly sounds like it. Again, just to fill a little detail in for our friends overseas, that meant you were travelling maybe 80 miles to a venue and 80 miles back. Is that about right? To Sheffield, I should think.
Yes, you're right, Steve. Yeah, it was 80 miles and 90 miles, and we used to go all the way up north. And by the time we finished was sometimes 1 o'clock in the morning, and then we had to travel back. And of course, you know, I was at that time. By the way, I had missed something out. I was married to my first wife, and I met her in actual fact in one of the pubs I used to play the piano, and. And she also worked at this Ministry of Labour. So, but she didn't come with us often as not, because by that time I had a child, I had a boy, and she was at home, and I used to then go up and I used to get back about 2 and 3 in the mornings. And of course, you know something, Steve, when we used to pull up outside my place where I lived, the boys thought it was hilarious, because what they did, you used to get all these empty beer cans, and as I was creeping into the front door, you know, I didn't want to waken any of the neighbours up, all of a sudden, these beer cans come after me. Clatter, 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 you know. So I had the name in that area as being the Nighthawk.
Yeah, okay. He wouldn't let you make a quiet entrance to your own house. Okay, that was their little parting shot, so to speak. Okay, so you were married to your first wife, and I know that you're now married to Shirley, and we'll probably come onto that later. I mean, you can say as much or as little as you like about what actually happened with your first wife. That's entirely up to you. I wouldn't want to press you in any way, shape or form. So I'll leave that up to you as to whether you actually tell us what actually happened. That you obviously did part. Shall we just leave it there?
Yeah, well, in actual fact, Steve, what happened was my first wife, she didn't like the way I was leading my life, and I was all over the country and playing and goodness knows what, and there's a little point of incompatibility, and strangely enough, I will say this, that at that time when things were a little bit estranged, Shirley, who was my existing wife, she came to work also at the Ministry of Labour, and she was appointed as my relief telephonist. And, well, from there, things developed. I don't think much further after that, Steve.
Okay, Jeff. Okay, that's understood. So we won't pursue that, but you know, I know you're very happily married to Shirley, and you have been for many years now. So we've got you playing the piano now. I believe we've got to push on a little bit, because there's a lot to fit in, there's a lot to Jeff Grant, so we're going to just push it forward a little bit. I know from what you've told me personally that you did in fact get onto the continent playing the piano. Is that correct? Have I got that right?
Yeah, okay, Steve. Yeah, what I did with the band, we toured France and the continent, and we used to play, our American friends would be interested in this, I used to play at a lot of the American camps. You know, we used to go all the way from Katsu, all the way to Strasbourg and various places in Germany, and to the officers' clubs in the American camps and the various venues, and played in Paris. And then also I took my band onto TV as well. That wasn't a full band, it was just a trio. And then also I did a solo as well on the TV. But we didn't enjoy, and I took Shirley with me at the time, and we had a cabaret and dancers and so forth. And we didn't enjoy working out of a suitcase because we were living in hotels all the while. So I decided to come back to England.
Okay, so that part of your life really was over, the actual touring around and playing. Now, I know Jeff Grant as a businessman, as the owner of quite a substantial warehouse and stuff. Now, he used to sell all sorts of things and probably still do, but that's probably a little way into the future. What gave you the idea to start up such an enterprise, and how did it come about? What were the beginnings of your business career?
Okay, Steve. Well, when I came back to England, Shirley, she found a job quite easily in an office, and she was a typist and so forth. And I had quite a job in finding myself a position. Eventually I found a job in the county architect's office, which is in Leicester, and I was a telephonist there, but I got very, very bored. Very bored indeed. And I thought I must do something different. And when adversity, you know, comes along, I think it makes one more determined. And what I did, I sort of think, well, I've got to do something. And even as a kid, when I was at school, I always used to take little bits I made. I used to have a little metal thing, you know, metal machine. I used to make little bits on it. I used to take it to little bits to school, little crosses and all sorts of things. I used to sell them for pennies and tuppences and all that sort of thing. Right, so I decided to have a look round. Well, during the lunch hours, Shirley used to meet me out, and we used to go down into the Leicester Market. Now, I don't know if the Americans know if they have these same things over in America, but the market is, well, Leicester one is the biggest in Europe. It's a very big market. And at that time, along one particular part of the market, they used to, what they call spiel. And you used to get somebody behind the market stall, stand up there, and give a demonstrations on what this can do and what that can do. And I went down there and all listening to them. I thought, well, I'd love to do that. And I went from there and I listened and listened. So eventually I found out where one could get all these goods from, what they did. I went to a particular warehouse, and this warehouse was a cinema. And it was quite a big place, and we used to go and buy things. And I said to Shirley, and her friend Pam, I said, why don't we set a stall up here, and you can pack your jobs up, and I'll stay in employment and see how things go. So we set the stall up, and they were down there 3 days a week and so forth. And during the lunch hour, I used to go down, and I used to go behind the stall, and then I used to what we call pitch or spiel. And I used to stand there on the box and tell the people all about this, that, and the other. And we used to get big crowds around us, and we used to go from there. I better wait for any more questions before I carry on, Steve.
Yeah, okay. I'm not asking £50. I'm not asking £25. Oh dear. What sort of things were you selling then, Jeff, at this stage?
Right at that stage, Steve, I was selling anything from radios, and I was selling toiletries and so forth. Yes, you've got it. you know, you say, look, you know, this is £9 something in the shop. Saying, I don't want £9, £8, £7 or £6. And of course, you know, the girls who was working with me, they used to what they call is floor. And if you've got a big crowd around you, you know, and they used to sort of thing, you know, come down to £7. They say, look, £7, you know, £6, I'm going to give you a real treat now, a real treat. And so Shirley and this other girl say, hang on, there's a person at the back wants one, and somebody over there wants one, and Mrs. Green had one once over there. Well, in all fairness to you, they weren't really there. Because when the people at the back started wanting to buy, all the ones in the crowd wanted to buy. And it was psychology, wasn't it, really? that's a good word for you. I could call it other things, but it might have been cheating. But anyway, we got quite a few people there, you know, putting their hands up, they wanted this, that, and the other. And I said, no, I don't want even your £7 or £6. I said, I'll tell you what, look, I'll get another six people. I said, I'll do it £5, you know. Six people, one, two, three, four, five, six. Okay, £5 is yours. And that's how he's gone. But the spiel used to last quite a long while on each thing. I used to tell them all about it, where it was made, what it would do, and so forth, Steve.
Okay, so eventually then, after you'd been doing this for a little while, you had the ambition to expand. So how did you actually come to own your actual warehouse itself? And it must have been quite difficult, I should think, getting financial backing, you know, to actually purchase such a building. Did it become redundant as a cinema and then you stepped in? Or how did you actually obtain it?
Okay, Steve, well, when I was on the market, I was doing that well, and my wife and myself used to go up into Lancashire, and my wife, Shirley, she used to drive these big lorries, and some of them were 40 foot long, and you know, Shirley's not the biggest girl, she's only about, 5'2", 5'3", and she used to drive these lorries all the way up to Yorkshire, and we used to go to the mills, where they made all the blankets and sheets and so forth, and we used to load them all on there, and then come back. And we got an old butcher shop, and that's where we first started doing the wholesale. And because we were so successful, the people on the market wanted to buy off me wholesale. And so we sort of thing filled all, we put all the stuff into this butcher shop. We converted into ordinary rooms, and the people used to come along and buy, and that's how the wholesale started. And I always were number one, so I told Shirley, I said, I bought another lorry, and this was a 16-wheeler. And it was that big, it was about 3,000 cube was the back of it. You could almost hold a dance in it. It's got rollers from the front to the back. You can imagine how big it was. And when we went for it, I said to Shirley, I said, well, whatever you do, when you get in this lorry, don't kangaroo it. Don't make it jump up and down. And she got in it, and of course, imagine people were looking from the offices, you know, and she drove it away. And that's the lorry we used to go and flex her from London or Yorkshire, whatever. And from there, things grew, and the place got much too small for us. And we accrued a little bit of money, and the place I used to buy my stuff from before I went on the markets, when I went on the markets, I eventually bought that same place, and that place was a cinema. It was a cinema that used to seat about 800 people before it was converted into a wholesale warehouse. And we bought that, yes, in 1963, I think it was. 63, I think, is the time, yes.
Okay, so you got these fleet of lorries and your warehouse eventually. How did you decide what sort of ranges you were going to sell? And indeed, what sort of ranges did you sell?
Right, we sold electrical items, things, household items like towels, blankets, sheets and so forth, things like soaps and toiletry items, toys, loads of toys at Christmas. We've done absolutely thousands and thousands of various toys. And as you can imagine, this place we had, the cinema, cinemas are normally are on a slope, aren't they? You know, the floor's on a slope, obviously, because you're looking at a screen. And that slope was always there. So we had these rollers coming from the top to the bottom. And when the customers came in, you know, the boys used to put my staff used to put the stuff on the rollers and used to roll down to the bottom. And Shirley used to check it out. I used to do all the buying. I was the main buyer and for all the items. And the type of items I sold, it was purely from supply and demand, Steve. If there was a demand there, we stocked it. We had an occasion when in 1970, you might get me right on this one, Steve, I think it was 72 or 73, something like that, there was the miners' strike, and everybody was without electricity. You might tell me exactly the date, I can't quite remember. And it was an opportune time for me then, because what I did, I started bringing in container loads of candles from Germany and various other parts of the continent. And when I brought these candles in, they used to queue up for them. Oh, we used to have queues and lorries lying in the street and vans all waiting for these candles to come in. So it was like every cloud had a silver lining, Steve.
Well, your cloud certainly did, and I think it's probably about 73-ish. Yes, when we had a national coal miners' strike over here in the UK, and all the unions came out in support, and we had a 3-day working week, and we had power cuts. We used to turn the electricity off for several days, well, in rotation. So of course candles were in big demand, so I can see why you were so popular, Jeff. But you said you were the main buyer, but how did you do the research? How did you know what was out there to buy as a blind person?
Okay, Steve. Now, people have asked me this before. It's something I could never teach anybody. It's you either you know it or you don't know it. It's nothing smart. It's nothing clever. It's a question you just get a nose for the right sort of things. And I always was able to assess a line and whether it would sell or not. Okay, I made mistakes. But I always said, as long as I made more good ones than bad ones, I'm going to succeed. And overall, yeah, I didn't make a lot of mistakes. But the ones that were good. And I was in the business then, you know, Steve, when transistors were in their infancy. You know, they just started coming on. And I used to sell transistors by the thousand. And I mean it by the thousand. So that was the sort of time when we really started. And of course, supermarkets were not quite in existence to what they are today, and they weren't doing the sort of items, so we were absolutely unique.
When you say transistors, I take it you mean tranny radios and all sorts of stuff like that. And I first met you probably in 77, and I bought tape recorders from you, cassette machines, the Sharp Talking Clock, which I still use to this day, you know, the original Sharp Talking Clock, and it's still going now. So that was a good buy, wasn't it, Jeff? You did me a good turn then. So, yeah, you sold all that type of novelty items and so on. How many lines did you actually stock at the peak? Any idea how many different items you actually sold?
Okay, Steve. Just a point. We'll go into that just for our American friends. The sort of operation we had was, although Walmart are more of a retailer, aren't they? But it's the type of characteristics that we had that they've got. They sort of thing, you know, stacked it high and sold it cheap. Walmart do that all the time, don't they? And they're massive, of course. And we used to do the same sort of thing. We sort of thing bought the stuff in. We worked on turnover, and we sort of thing sold it very, very fast indeed. Now your question. I'm just trying to think what it was, Steve. My memory's gone. This is age, isn't it? Just come back on that one question. Sorry, Steve.
That's no problem, Jeff. How many lines did you sell? How many different types of product were you selling at your peak?
Okay, Steve, yes. I would say it would go into the thousands, literally thousands. You know, you'd take the toiletry items. I mean, there's all the hair, shampoos, preparations, dyes, you know, colors for the hair, deodorants, soaps, washing powders, and so forth. And then, of course, you come on to, you know, like the textiles, you know, sheets, blankets, and pillowcases, and toys, oh, hundreds and hundreds of various toys, and radios, jewelry. And so, yeah, it would go literally into thousands. And at that time of day, Steve, I hadn't got no computer, and it was all down to memory. And sometimes, you know, you could make the odd mistake where you could overstock, because, you know, rep coming from the big companies like Smith, Klein, Beecham and them sort of people. And you possibly ordered another container of Brill Cream or something, and you found out afterwards you got a lot in your rack. I mean, it didn't happen often, but it did occasionally.
Oh, what a terrible thought. yeah, I could just imagine that. Yeah, thousands of jars of Brill Cream and stuff. So all this was going on with just a small team of people, I imagine. How many people were helping you in the day-to-day running of the business?
Okay, Steve. Well, I would say, you know, somewhere about 20 people worked in the warehouse. And then, of course, I developed another company as well, which was an import company, and we used to bring in knitting wool from Turkey, Istanbul, and we used to bring this wool in, and used to be in sort of thing, packets of 8 balls of wool, all the colours under the rainbow. We used to import that in massive lots, and then we used to refactor that out to other wholesalers. So we was wholesaling to wholesalers in the finish as well with the knitting wool and so forth. And so, and also we used to bring in container loads, import directly from Hong Kong and China, a load of toys and various items like that.
Yeah, okay, yeah. It's a massive operation, isn't it? I think you told me once that your setup was one of the biggest in the Midlands of England. It's quite a sizable operation, wasn't it? And were you now, this is Shirley will smile, I expect. I'll be able to hear Shirley laughing, I expect. Were you a good delegator? Were you good at giving other people things to do, or were you a very much hands-on, I'll do it myself guy?
Steve, I was a terrible delegator. Terrible. I wasn't very good at it at all, and I look back with hindsight, I wish I had been a better delegator. I'd been possibly more successful. And it was a question that, I don't know what it is about one, but you think that somebody else can't do it as well as you, but that's absolutely stupid. You tend to sort of think you've got to do it all. And I found out I was doing most of the buying, and I was sort of thing giving basic instructions. And Shirley, she doesn't mind me saying this, she was a very good gopher. but she did play a very big part in my success, Steve.
Yeah, I'm sure she did. I'm sure she did. So can you just briefly give us the idea of a typical day for you, trying to juggle all these various enterprises and things? Just run through a pretty typical day that you used to have at this point.
Okay, Steve. Yeah, well, used to get there at more often than not about 8:30 in the morning, and then I used to have possibly 3 phones on my desk. And they started ringing, and it was making decisions all the time, both over the phone and also seeing reps that used to call into the office. So that went on, you know, for most of the day. But then when I got some big buyers coming, the bigger buyers, I used to possibly see them myself, and we used to go around the showroom and show them various items. I thought I could sell to them better than anyone else, which was possibly totally wrong. But all the big boy ones that used to come, I basically saw them myself. And that went on for the day. We used to carry on until sometimes 6, and on a Friday until 10 at night. And you know something, Steve? We, Sheila and myself, we never had a holiday for 15, 17 years. So it was really, you know, people said, well, how did I do it? And quite honestly, I'm going to just say this, it was blood, sweat and tears.
I should think you were absolutely mentally and physically exhausted at the end of every day doing that for, well, probably 7 days a week. Knowing you, you probably didn't take any time off. So it must have been very mentally exhausting. How did the reps from different companies react to you as a blind guy? You know, coming in to sell you something, and there you were, a totally blind guy. How did they react to you, and how did you react to them?
A good question, that, Steve. It's something I've studied for quite a while. Right, when they came in and they got to know me, there was no problem. I got on very well with them, but if, assuming, say, Shirley was there, or one of my assistants were there, the whole thing, a lot of our friends will be aware of this, that they always made eye contact with the other person. That used to annoy me immensely. I mean, we all know this, Steve. You know, you're in a room and you're talking to somebody, and they answer the question by looking at somebody else, often as not. And I used to get inside a little bit annoyed, and it was only the newer ones that used to do that. The older ones, when I knew them, they didn't. They looked at me and I looked at them. But the older ones, the newer ones that tend to do this, and I used to say to them, I say, excuse me, I said, are you speaking to Shirley, are you speaking to me? And from that moment on, they changed their attitude, Steve.
Yeah, once they got to know that you were the boss, that was okay, that was fine. And as a blind person running a business like this, with thousands of pounds worth of stock around you, did you ever at any stage feel vulnerable to threat or anything like that? Or have you ever had any incidents of people trying to put one over on you? Or did you feel vulnerable in any way?
Right, Steve. Yeah, well, because, you know, at that time, altogether, I've had like 7 companies. And I sold them. I sold one or two of my companies. Certain ones I sold the actual business and I retained the property. Others I sold the property as well as the business. But I went to another warehouse and talking about vulnerable, yeah, on one occasion, I remember this very, very distinctly. It happened in 1973. And the staff had gone home. It was the 4th of November. I'm sure it was the 4th of November. It was the day before bonfire night. And the staff had just gone home, and it was dark, just gone 6 o'clock at night, and I'd just gone into the toilets, and Shirley was cashing up in the office. And I'd just come out the toilets, and I just heard Shirley shouting, and what happened was, there was 2 men in balaclavas, and they got a gun, and let me just tell you, yes, that's right, and... they was in the passageway, and they got this gun, and of course, I went for one of them. I'm reasonably fit, well, I was at that time of day, and he was a smaller guy, in actual fact. The other one was a pretty big guy, and I wrestled with him, but he put the gun in my side and said if I didn't pack it up, sort of thing, he was going to shoot me and that sort of thing. So they bundled us into the kitchen at the back. And they got the keys off me, so they wanted to go and lock the front door. Now, at this particular time, I'd got a case for, you know, I'd got quite a lot of money in a briefcase, and it was ready for banking. So somebody obviously must have set us up for this. And anyway, the bundlers into this kitchen at the back, and they went to lock the front door. Well, the front door was a difficult door to do, to lock up. And he shouted to his mate. He says, "Come and give me a hand. I can't lock this damn door." And because as the other one went, and we was in the kitchen, Shirley tapped me on the shoulder, and she jumped on top of the kitchen unit, and rolled herself out of the window, which was about an 8-foot drop, and dropped the other side. And I then put my foot against the door so they couldn't get back in easily. And by the time they pushed the door open, they just said, "Where's your wife?" I said, "Oh, she's gone." And they ran. But previous to this, they had gone through all my pockets, and they took about £700. But she got away. But once she had gone, they ran and, you know, went away. But it was very good, really, because if they'd already cut the flex of the phone, and they'd got some wire, and they was going to tie us up. Now, if that had happened, this was a Friday night, and because we got, you know, the weekend, possibly somebody wouldn't have missed us to possibly at least a day afterwards. It could have been pretty bad. But fortunately, Shirley managed to get this way of getting away. And the insurance people were that pleased that although we weren't insured for cash on premises, or not the money anyway that was there, they gave us quite a reasonable sum to redeem what we had lost, because there was, there must have been thousands and thousands of pounds worth of watches. Now they could have got all that in one car. So really speaking, we did save an awful lot by Shirley's rather brave way of getting through the window.
Wowie, what an experience. And that is in a relatively crime-free area in sleepy old England. So you see, it can happen over here as well. We do have our share of armed robberies. You were very, very lucky, Jeff. It must have been a very awful experience to have that done to you. I suppose it goes without saying that they were never apprehended, and I expect you were scared for a long time after that they'd come back.
Yeah, see, when Shirley dropped through the window, she went, you know, obviously to raise the alarm. And, of course, it took the police, I would say, about 20 minutes in which to get to the site. And, of course, there would have been armed people on the premises. And, yeah, you're quite right, Steve. Afterwards, it lived with us for a long, long while. And they were apprehended. They were found doing another job in Birmingham. And apparently they'd done 4 or 5, and the job they'd done with me was taken into consideration. And I think they got quite a few years. But we didn't have to appear in court at all, but they had them on all the others. But afterwards, you know, when you went home, you always made sure your doors were locked, and your security outlook took quite a big turn. You never really trusted an awful lot of circumstances. You used to sort of thing, lock doors, and if you went upstairs, you thought, well, okay, lock the back door and so forth. And I always remember my bank manager, because he had a similar experience at the bank, and he says to me, he said, what it does, it's not just what's happened to you, it's the memory it leaves. And he said he's lived with it for about 10 years.
Yes, I can well imagine that. Must have been a horrendous experience for you, and enough to put you off, I should think. But obviously it didn't put you off, and you continued to run your businesses and be very, very successful. Now, again, it may be a difficult question for you to answer, Jeff, but I'd like you to try. Is there such a thing, would you say, as a business brain? And is it also true, again, it's unfair to ask you this, but I'm going to ask you nevertheless, would you say that you have to have a ruthless streak? I've heard this before, that, you know, that to get on in business, you do have to split yourself in two, and you know, there's the work, and then there's the leisure. So is there such a thing as a business brain, and do you have to be ruthless to succeed in business?
Yes, Steve, you have. You've got to have a certain amount of aggression in your makeup. If you haven't, I'm afraid you will never make an entrepreneur in any way. You've got to have a certain amount of aggression, and yes, to some degree, yeah, ruthless. But at the same time, being fair. And yes, I had this. It was a part of my life. I've always been, I wouldn't say aggressive, but I've had that certain amount in me. And when I was at school, you know, I was always the one for wrestling and boxing and all that sort of stuff. And I think that was a part of my makeup, Steve, yes. I think one has to have this thing. And regarding a business brain, it's something you've not got to be academically clever. I think you've got to have a certain amount of insight and a bit to assess people. I'm rather proud of the fact that I can assess people, and I can read them fairly well. So yeah, that does help a lot. A bit of aggression, a lot of determination, and I think most people can make it, Steve.
Yeah, I'm sure, but we haven't all got that. And you are extremely successful. I've been to your home recently, and it is a beautiful, beautiful place you've got there. And you are extremely successful guy. And it's honestly, I'm not flattering you. It's a privilege to know you, because you've done extremely well. You've done so well. You know, 99.9 of sighted people wouldn't achieve what you've achieved. And I'm not just saying that. I really do mean that. So we've got to start to wrap it up now, unfortunately, because I've really enjoyed talking to you. I take it you're now sort of slowing down. You've eased your foot off the throttle a little bit, but I imagine that you will continue. I can't really see you ever letting go completely. Have I read you correctly, or not? Have you had enough now? Or are you still itching to do the next deal?
Well, thank you very much, Steve, for those very kind words. But yes, I suppose, yeah, I'm almost ready for packing it up, and I'm 95% retired. But I'm still sort of thing open to a good deal, and a lot of my contacts that I've made over many, many years, because I've been in the business for about 38 years, they still contact me, and it's quite nice to know they often ask me my opinion and my advice on various things. So I'm in touch with an awful lot of those people that were my customers, and I suppose, yeah, we're getting to the point whereby I'm saying, yes, enough is enough. And we're trying to enjoy the fruits now of what we've worked for, Steve, and we've worked very hard. But I think there comes a time when you've got to realize you've got to let go. Now, those two words means an awful lot, letting go. It's a hard thing, Steve. It's very, very difficult. When you're in something and you're so involved, it's damned hard to let it go. And it took me, I would think, almost 5 years to come to that decision. Each year I get a little nearer, but so a little voice inside me says, well, carry on a bit longer. But I'm almost coming to the point now whereby I don't hear that voice so much.
Yeah, and just as a few final thoughts, what would you say, out of all your experiences, was your greatest achievement? What are you most proud of?
One of my biggest achievements. I should imagine, I've got to be careful to say, I should say marrying Shirley. What about that?
Sounds good to me, Jeff. That sounds good to me. And just finally, as I say, I went to your venting home, because we lost touch, didn't we, for quite a few years, and I found your name on an email list and contacted you, and you know, we've been in touch now a little while, and Sue and myself came to visit you. Just finally, just tell the listeners to Spotlight where you're actually living now, and a little bit about the home where you live with Shirley at the present time, because it's a really beautiful place.
Okay, Steve, yeah, well, I live in, it's a bungalow, and it's within, well, I've got about, 12 acres of ground altogether, although we don't garden all those 12 acres. Biggest part of it we let off to a farmer, and he puts his cows on it, and so therefore we don't have to garden that, because Shirley, she loves gardening, by the way, she loves it. I do a bit of it, I do a bit of the humping around, Steve, but Shirley does all the flowers and all the various things, you know. And the place itself, yes, it's inside, it's quite a, as you know, Steve, because you've been, it's quite a nice big lounge. I've got a nice Steinway grand piano in there, which is lovely, and it's got a balcony type round, and upstairs where I am now, I've got my shack where I've got my shortwave, my computer, and various other little things, and yes, it's quite a nice size, and a couple of garages and so forth. What else I can say about it? Yes, it's a nice place, and also, of course, I've got a nice little villa as well in Cyprus, as you well know, and I've just come back from Cyprus, and I've got a lovely villa there. It's right on the beach, and in Larnaca Bay.
Yes, and I had the pleasure of speaking to you from there just the other day with the wonders of the computer. Well, Jeff, can I, on behalf of the listeners to Spotlight, thank you for agreeing to be interviewed. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And that's really the end of the official interview, so I'd just like to thank you and just throw it open if anyone would like to ask you questions about what we've been talking about. If that's okay with you, please feel free to do so, and thanks again, Jeff.
Right, I'll just stand by. Anybody wants to ask me any questions, I'll certainly try to answer them.
Hey Jeff, this is Becky. I thoroughly enjoyed this. This is most interesting interview. You have had a fascinating life, boy oh boy. But what I have to ask you, Jeff, when you went for that robber, did you know he had a gun in his hand?
Becky, no, you were damn right I didn't know. No, I hadn't a clue, and I thought he was playing, and he wasn't playing. Yes, he had got the gun there, but I don't think I would have gone to him if he'd got a gun. If I had been, I'd have been a fool, wouldn't I?
Well, I think it's pretty spunky that you chose to go for him at all, and not even seeing where he was, what his size was, or anything about him. You just probably did it as a response. But that is fascinating. And do you get to do anything now with your music? I see you say you have a piano in your home. Do you still get to enjoy that talent?
Okay, Biggie. I just occasionally play. I'm nowhere near as standard what I was. I'm pretty useless, really, to what I used to be, because I used to play so many hours, you know, a week. But now, just to keep myself a little bit in touch. But I'm by no means a real exponent on the piano any longer. And when you've got your business, it was taking so much of my time up. In fact, during my business career, I went without a piano for about 12 years. I never even owned a piano. And so really, I lost touch, and my repertoire sort of thing is diabolical. I've missed out on a lot of phases in music and so forth. So, yeah, it's. But I still enjoy tinkling around on the piano, Becky.
Well, Yeah, I just put a humorous thing in, Becky, knowing Jeff. If he thought the robber needed a gun, he'd probably have said to him, oh, I've got some toy ones if you want to buy one.
Going real cheap.
Yeah, I don't think it would made a big impression. You know, these people that come in, and by the way, I must say this, with these two who came in, one of them was extremely nervous. The bigger one of the two was very nervous. I could read him like a book, and he was nervous. And a nervous man with a gun is something to be frightened of. I'd rather have a competent man with a gun, but not a nervous man with a gun.
Do they know that you couldn't see?
Yeah, in actual fact, they must have known, because I think we know the person who set us up, and because I was dealing with him for at least a couple of years. But in putting two and two together, we're pretty sure we knew who set us up, but it was never proven.
I'm sorry, I should have introduced myself. I'm Anita from New Hampshire. I have spoken with you before.
Oh, that was Anita. Was sorry about Anita. Yeah, it was quite an experience, and it's something that I wouldn't wish on anybody. You know, you read about them, hear about them on the radio and the TV, and they just roll off you, don't you? But when it happens to you, that's a different matter.
I was just wondering. I missed it because I made myself some popcorn. What type of business was?
I didn't quite get the question there. What type of trade I was in business? Right. Well, I was in a business. It was wholesale business, selling many types of merchandise. You know, like toys, household goods, and toiletries, and so forth. And then, of course, we had an import concern as well. And we also done a bit of exporting as well. And then we finished up, by the way, Steve, I didn't finish this part of it. We finished up by having a string of stores, you know, quite a few stores, and put a manager in charge of them. But that's another story. That's quite a long story.
Okay, Jeff, no problem. And yeah, I take it you still got those. What sort of thing do they say, just quickly?
No, I haven't got the actual businesses, Steve. I own the properties, but not the business. And they sell very similar items to what we did. Yeah, toiletries and so forth. All things to do with the home and things of that nature.
Yeah, okay. That's fine.
Any other questions?
I would like to know then, how good has been your instinct in knowing what would be good products to have on your shelves and what would not?
Yeah, good question. I was explaining earlier on that you developed some sort of a I call it a nose, if you like, for these things. You can smell them out, you know, you can tell whether thing sells or not. I mean, I've been asked this question many times, and you just developed knowing whether the good ones are than the bad ones. And as I said earlier on, yes, I have made mistakes, but providing you make more good moves and you do bad, you know, you do succeed. And yeah, it didn't take too long, and I just had a natural instinct for buying and selling, I suppose. Come on, any more questions? Surely there's somebody out there who wants to know one or two other things.
Jeff, do you do any mail order selling, or is it strictly a store selling?
When we was in the wholesale business, and not the shops or stores, We did try a little mail order, but we weren't particularly successful. With mail order, it's you've got to be very persistent with the same item. And it's only about the fifth or sixth time you're advertising do you get a good response. And I wasn't really prepared to go along that road, really. There are some people who made fortunes out of mail ordering, and I think now armchair shopping is certainly stronger now than it ever was.
Do you have a website that advertises your products? And I have experience in doing catalog computer processing of orders. If you ever decide to put out a catalog, please ask Jen about me. My name is Vanilla Bon Bon, alias Julie from Superior, Wisconsin. But I was just wanting to know about.
No, I haven't a website. I'm almost ready for retirement, and I didn't get to the point of developing a website because my computing experience is pretty limited, and it's not till the last, you know, few years I've been playing around with it, and when I was really in business in a big way, computing was not in my mind at all. I think possibly, yeah, if I was doing the same things now, I certainly would have a website, but no is the answer on that one.
This is a thing you should think of, because my landlord, for instance, his father was a CEO at a bank and owned 42 properties in my community. This is just a small town. Now he's retired in Florida, and my landlord is stuck with all the caretaking, but the man in Florida is making all kind of money off of these properties. And so if you had other people help you and do a website, you probably could do an international business to an even greater degree than you have already.
The thought's pretty good. I don't know whether I've got the motivation right now. That is a thing, you know. As you go through, you generally lose a little bit of this motivation, and I don't know whether. Well, I don't think I would be prepared to go down that road now. I've been just saying to let go is a very difficult thing, and I'm 95% along the road of letting go. I mean, I've been in it, you know, getting on for 40 years. And there's a time in your life when, okay, you're going to sort of thing, give it up and enjoy some of the fruits that you've worked for. And I think I'm going along that road more and more, in actual fact.
This is Don. Maybe then it would be interesting for us to know what your plans are in your retirement. What kind of interest would you like to pursue? What do you hope to do with that extra time?
Okay, Don, that is a damn good question. Quite frankly, I'm finding, you know, that I don't get a lot of time on my hands, and I'm never bored. I've always got something to do, a bit of listening to music, a bit of playing the music, a bit of playing around with the computer, and speaking to you lovely people over in America. And, you know, and then, you know, we do a bit of travel. We travel a little bit as well. We go on one or two holidays, and I do a bit of socializing and so forth. Don, to answer your question, no, I'm not a bored person. I've got a very sort of thing, full life, and I think it's important that one should have this, and I can't see me ever really being bored anyway.
Okay, Jeff, well, I'm going to depart now. Thanks again for the interview. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and hope it wasn't too daunting for you.
Yes, thank you so much, Jeff, for coming on, and Steve, thank you. It was a very nice job.
I'd like to add my thanks, too. It was a very interesting interview.
Thanks a lot, Jeff. Really enjoyed it. There's a lot to a guy like you, isn't there? Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks, Steve, for your work.
This is the first time I've ever been to this, and I really enjoy it.
It was very, very good. I was listening to it here in the background because I had some other things I desperately had to get done, but it was a very nice interview. And thank you very much for coming, Jeff.
Well, thank you all anyway for listening, and I hope I've not bored any of you, but, you know, yes, I've had a full life, and people do say to me I should write a book. that might be an idea, might it? I might give a bit of time to writing a book and making as interesting as I can, but may I thank you all anyway for listening, and no doubt I'll be chatting to you again and in one or two of the chat rooms. So I wish you all a very good evening, and thank you, Steve, for your tolerance and your technique in interviewing. Very, very good indeed, and thanks all. I'll be saying cheerio to you, and look forward to having a chat with you later. Bye.
Catch you later, Jeff.